KCSU-FM Stanford, welcome to another edition of Hearsay Culture. My name is Dave Levine. I'm a professor at Elon University School of Law, as well as an affiliate scholar at the Center for Internet and Society at Stanford Law School. Thank you for joining me today on the show. Today I'm excited to have on Professor Evan Selinger of Rochester Institute of Technology, who's going to be discussing concerns and issues and perspectives on technology and how it impacts our lives. Now, that is broad. Of course, you might say that that is really what hearsay culture is about. But one of the interesting things about Evan's work and why I'm excited to have on the show is that Evan focuses on philosophy. And the philosophy of technology is an area which is not wildly covered and I don't think very well understood. And quite frankly, there aren't a lot of scholars that focus in that area. Evan's work, which has been in a variety of mainstream press outlets like Wired and The Atlantic and Slate and Wall Street Journal that I've been reading over the last several years, I think is very insightful and very interesting because he paints a rather complex picture of what technology is doing well and what it isn't. He's a regular author with a former guest on the show who was on just a few weeks ago, Woody Hartzog at Stanford. And Evan's work, again, focuses on a variety of areas. Today we're going to be focusing on an area that he is increasingly focusing on, which is this question of how we use technology to act in ways that impact our humanity and whether those impacts on our humanity, on basic human emotions like anger and socialization and friendships are good or not and whether they work well. And so we're going to be going in that direction. We've had on the show over the last several years a couple of people that focus on philosophy. Most recently, we had on Professor Vance Ricks from Guilford College, who was talking about philosophical issues of reputation online. I'm also looking forward to having on later in the year Professor Gordon Hull from UNC Charlotte, who I've also been following and enjoy his work for the last several years, and he's going to be on discussing his work, which focuses directly on philosophy and technology. But we really haven't done a lot with it, so I'm very excited to have Evan on today. Evan is, as I mentioned, an associate professor of philosophy at RIT in upstate New York, where he's also affiliated with the Center for Media, Arts, Games, Interaction, and Creativity, which, again, I mean, I'm surprised that this isn't a Washington think tank because, yes, that acronym is MAGIC. He's also a fellow at the Institute for Ethics and Emerging Technology and serves on the advisory board of the Future of Privacy Forum. He focuses on ethical and philosophy issues involving technology and science, and he has written not only in academic journals but also in mainstream press. He also writes and blogs at eselinger.org. He is joining us via Skype from Pittsburgh, I believe. Evan, thank you much for joining us today on Hearsay Culture.
Oh, thanks for having me.
So, Evan, let's start off with a bit more background, a question I ask virtually everyone on the show. Tell us more about your background and your focus and how you became interested in this very broad and interesting topic.
So the thing with academics, when you ask them what they do, I often wonder if the answers that they give are true or they're sort of like after-the-fact ad hoc stories designed to sort of make it seem like they were destined to do something. Because I feel like my academic career has definitely meandered around a lot of different areas and has been constantly adapting. I've been at RIT since 2003. That was right after I defended my dissertation. And certainly spending 11 years being at a predominantly science and engineering-oriented university with students who are very hardworking and are sort of aspiring to be really future innovators in technical fields. When you're in that environment, you begin to be interested in a certain set of problems. And maybe that's different than some of the problems I was interested in towards the end of graduate school. And that's, you know, a little bit different than what I was interested in when I first came into philosophy. So a lot of this is sort of constantly, it's sort of constantly changing. But when I went into philosophy, you know, as an undergrad, I was really interested in, I guess, sort of more avant-garde, sort of continental philosophy. That was stuff that held out a lot of intrigue. But then over the years, I've become much more interested in ethics and much more interested in really the intersection between ethics and technology. Some of the things that I'm interested in are definitely on larger systematic levels, but the project that I'm most excited about right now, this project that I'm calling Outsourcing Humanity, is much more about thinking about the ethics of our everyday decisions with technology. And I have to say that being at a place like RIT where, you know, when you have students that are building all kinds of, you know, social technical systems, the ability to talk with them about their daily lives revolving around technology and the kinds of worlds that they're hoping to create in that, it definitely makes me feel like I'm on the right track with something by shifting to that focus.
Now, I'm going to ask you a bit of a curveball question here, Evan, and as you know, I don't play gotcha on Hearsay Culture, so I'm not doing that here. It's not, I mean, I say it kiddingly. It's not really a curveball. But I'm just noticing I read off your bio from eCulture.org, and now I have a question which may be totally irrelevant and not get us anywhere, but I'm going to ask anyway, which is there's a picture of you on the front page in your bio. You're sitting in what appears to be a rock garden. There's a small pond type behind you, and then there is a structure which looks to me like a robot. Now, maybe it's because I had Ryan Kahlo and Woody Hartsong on a few weeks ago talking about robots that I see this, but what is that? Is that and is there meaning behind it, or am I really going way too far afield?
Oh, sometimes a cigar is just a cigar, and that's the case here. That was actually one of the pictures taken, I think, by somebody that does photography at RIT years ago. So you're looking at, RIT is, for the most part, if you look at the structure of the campus, you know, it's very brick, very built, preservative efficiency, and in a sort of playful way, there's an annual celebration once a year called Brick City. But then there are, you know, in the cracks and crevices, other kinds of aesthetics. And so that's called, I think it's like the Zen Garden, which is right on campus. So what you're noticing is, because it's on campus, you can get a glimmer of the Zen Garden, but there's all kinds of sort of industrial and brick things close by. But that's it. Just the contingencies of that juxtaposition.
Which may be an interesting allegory to what we're going to talk about today, right? This intersection of technology and what we do as humans. Because it does seem like I don't know you well, you seem relaxed in that setting, and yet, you know, there is stuff in the background now that I look. Okay, well, that tangent, or maybe just utterly irrelevant divergence. Let's return to our focus here. You use the word outsourcing, and perhaps before I even get into the broad themes we're going to talk about, I want to address that because outsourcing, of course, is generally a commercial doctrine, right, where one entity actually contracts work of a given sort to another entity, which then performs that work for the benefit of the original contractor. And it has this commercial idea. It also has, can have a negative connotation. Certainly if you talk to organized labor and say outsourcing, right, the view is, right, losing U.S. jobs to competitors outside our borders that don't have the same health and safety and salary issues here. Outsourcing can also be viewed generally as a way to save money, which of course can have positive attributes if we think about government, although outsourcing also changes perhaps the value structure if the government is going to give work to a private sector entity whose focus is profits rather than public service. All of that by way of saying, why do you choose the word outsourcing to discuss this issue of how technology impacts our lives?
So I think that is a fantastic question, because every metaphor that an academic chooses is definitely value-laden and loaded with interest. And so here, I'm happy that it is a sort of overdetermined word that resonates in different ways. And so you just picked up on, I think, one of the most dominant uses. I'm glad that is sort of, it's there when I'm speaking, even if that's not the particular register that I'm intending. When I talk about outsourcing, I really mean externalizing, right? So I'm talking about taking functions or certain kinds of labor that we could be performing ourselves and externalizing them to technology. So having the technology do it for us, right? Having the technology act as a surrogate or a proxy. But the reason I like outsourcing is because I'm often thinking about the effects upon us and the people we interact with when we externalize in that way. And outsourcing always connotes to me, at least viscerally, some sense of labor. And that's really part of what I'm focusing on, is this idea that some of the work that's can be inefficient, it can be taxing, it's the kind of work that it's easy to think that life will be better if we can just do less of. in many instances, this is the hard but meaningful work that makes life important, that allows us to become virtuous people and build up the kinds of virtues that really make us moral beings. And so, in part, I'm seizing on the outsourcing metaphor because of its connection with work. I think it's relatable in that sense, but I do think, although this is really more in the background, we probably could make some interesting connections to some of the more traditional business literatures in outsourcing. Because in the business literatures, of course, the proposition is if you have some core value that defines your company and you're squandering resources that could be better allocated towards preserving and enhancing that core value, it often makes instrumental sense to be able to outsource some of those secondary tasks. A question companies always face is, are they always really clear on what are the primary tasks that really define their value? And can they misunderstand them, right? Is it possible to liquidate some of the value of your company by failing to grasp that some of the things that you're doing that you didn't understand as part of your core value really are? And that metaphor of outsourcing has certainly been picking up in other domains that I'm jumping onto also. There are all kinds of people in the sort of, you know, self-hack community that talk about outsourcing your life, and you find some even economic rationalization for this. This idea that people are very bad at sort of pricing what their time is, and there's a sense that people are sort of overly enamored with a sort of do-it-yourself ethos, and that they might be stigmatizing the idea of becoming more reliant on other people taking over services. So there's been this huge polemic that part of the key to improving your life is to capitalize on the new opportunities for outsourcing that are available. But I often think that that veneer of figuring out exactly where the inefficiencies are and valuing your time, it turns out to be a lot more morally complicated than I think a lot of the boosters would lead us to believe.
We're chatting with Evan Selinger from RIT on KZSU-FM Stanford and Hearsay Culture. So let, again, from the broad perspective, Evan, you know, you're generally concerned about control that technology exercises over our lives. Now, that, of course, is a huge issue. But perhaps, again, and this is an academic question, how do you define the word control? What is your concern or your focus when you think about control of our lives via technology?
So part of what I'm thinking about with this project is definitely a little bit of what I would consider to be sort of future-oriented philosophy or sort of ethics on the offense. And what I mean by that is, and I'm sure as I've heard, you know, different speakers, particularly from the law and technology community on your show, there's always that saying that technology and innovation moves quicker than the law. And I think the same is true with ethics. So when you ask me about control, right, part of what I'm focusing on is where I think things are moving and the kinds of control that I think we might be losing. And that isn't so much about necessarily looking out, you know, looking out your window right now, but I definitely think the way that the Internet of Things is heating up, the way that big data is moving, these issues of control are going to become more paramount. So you asked me, how would I define control? Mm-hmm. I would begin by saying I would place control within a spectrum, and I would situate that spectrum within a larger and more fundamental concept. And that more fundamental concept, for me, is a concept that we get out of a certain tradition in philosophy of technology, usually associated with phenomenology, that would be the tradition of thinking about technology as a mediation. So this concept of mediation. By mediation, what I mean and what others have meant is, the more that we use technology to not just sort of actualize our pre-established desires and preferences, but the more that the use of technology affects how we perceive the world, how we think about problems, and how we behave, that type of mediation fundamentally affects how we are in the world and the kinds of norms that develop. And so I'm focusing on the issue of mediation for a minute to say that normally, it's not about technology as something that completely controls us, right? It's not about some sort of talisman that has completely sort of autonomous powers, nor is it about what philosophers of technology would call the instrumental relation to technology, this idea that technology is some value-neutral conduit that we can simply shape to our own ends. Given the way that we've evolved, given our sort of cognitive tendencies And given the kinds of embodied limitations that we have, whenever we use technology as a primary way to think and to act and to perceive, it's going to affect those very processes. And so the way that those processes get affected, we could probably map onto spectrums of having more or less control, delegating more and more actions, in which case we're talking about distributed actions, and maybe even distributed responsibility. Ultimately, my interest with control have to do with the fact that I think in this age of big data, and as we're sort of moving towards the Internet of Things, more and more of our information is going to be sort of surveyed and analyzed and cataloged, and we're going to be given all sorts of algorithmic guidance as to what to do given that. And it's our negotiation with that guidance. That's where I think these issues of control are going to become salient.
So, Evan, let me I hear what you're saying. Let me ask you kind of a concrete question. So, can you give
Sure.
our listeners a current example of this issue or the problems associated with this issue existing today to kind of move from a little bit more abstract take on it to something that is occurring now in people's lives?
Great. So let's answer this in a kind of spectrum-y way then. Let's start off with what it is to delegate awareness, and then that itself is giving up a certain amount of control, and then we'll shift to sort of recommendations. So you and I have talked in the past, you know, just about what it's like to be not just an academic, but what it's like to be a parent, okay? So my daughter is 7. Right now, I'm not terribly worried about this issue, but I have anticipatory anxiety about what's going to happen when she gets just a little bit older. Because in the digital age, the big question I think parents have to ask is how much of their monitoring are they going to be outsourcing to technology, right? I mean, parenting has always had this sort of struggle with, you know, you want your kids to be safe, you don't want them falling into the wrong crowd, but you also want to give them ample opportunities to be able to sort of develop and develop autonomy and to learn to take responsibility for making decisions, including bad decisions. And so one of the things that we're starting to notice is that, you know, the sort of parental surveillance industry is growing by leaps and bounds. It's incredibly easy, if one wants, to install all kinds of software on, you know, computers and phones that will give you, you know, updated reports on what your kid is doing, where they're going, you know, sort of GPS enabled, are they moving past a safe zone, who they're talking to. We could begin to understand that as a form of outsourcing because that begins to give you sort of effortless, frictionless information that otherwise would be hard to get, right? Having conversations with your kids about this can be incredibly taxing. That's a way of sort of outsourcing sort of awareness. And so on some basic level, all parents are going to have to sort of figure out, right, how much are they going to want to have direct observation, direct dialogue, and how much are they going to try to circumvent some of that through outsourcing? That's about outsourcing awareness, which I do think has moral dimensions, right? It affects what we're paying attention to, how we're obliged to pay attention, and the quality of interactions we're going to have. But there's tons of technologies already started to be rolled out that isn't just about outsourcing that awareness. It starts to come with sort of recommendations to them. So, for example, you might be using a fitness tracking app, and your fitness tracking app might be, much like the parenting example that I'm giving you, tracking all kinds of things. It might be tracking how far you're running, how often you're going to the gym, sort of keeping tabs on these things. You could sort of socially network this so that you're also emitting that information to other people in your network and that you're also aware of what other people are doing. That in turn can create sort of, you know, social pressures, which might be good, might be bad. These things quickly are going to be dovetailing with, I think, more and more sort of recommendations for, you know, you should be running more, you should be eating more of this kind of thing. We're starting to see, you know, devices like Google Now already sort of anticipating our needs. And so I think more and more we're already beginning to see this sort of economy of basic consumer technologies that can do things from sort of monitor what's going on with those that we care about, monitor what's going on with us, and begin to give us more and more guidance as to how we should sort of, you know, live in the world given the kinds of information that we're sending out there.
We're chatting with Evan Selinger of RIT on KZSO FM Stanford and Hearsay Culture. So, Evan, let me ask you this. Again, these are all kind of preliminary questions, though we're getting into the substance. So, there are a range of scholars who focus on these kind broadly these kinds of questions about what technology is doing to us, or whether it's helping or hurting us as humans. And of course, you're very familiar with all of this literature. But you've got people that are now, and I think the moniker now is overused, but are viewed as Luddites, which very simply they're viewed as anti-technology, although that's not usually the case. It's more a matter of they're skeptical about some of the prognostications and beliefs about its abilities. And then, of course, you have, again, overused. You got the utopians who are painted as seeing no problems with technology. I think as we evolve our understanding of technology, as you point out, as we have more data about what it does, people are becoming more granular. Having said that, right, and painted in this very black and white way, do you place yourself on the spectrum with regard to your general outlook towards philosophy? Do you accept that spectrum? And if so, where would you put yourself on it?
So there's definitely, I could say a few people whose work I appreciate, and I'll do that in a second to sort of help sort of figure out exactly, I guess, where on that spectrum I am. But on just a simple everyday conversational level, right? I'm not a Luddite at all, right? I mean, in many ways, I'm a cyborg. You can't help but being a cyborg. I mean, we live in an incredibly technologically mediated world. There is no outside of, technological mediation. So for me, the question becomes how we can, sort of design those mediations in ways that are sort of better for us, morally speaking, as opposed to, in some way worse, right? Make us less virtuous, less caring, less conscientious, less autonomous. And especially being at a technology school, I mean, I think this has impacted my thinking in a tremendous way, right? When I teach like a traditional liberal, and I don't mean liberal in the political sense of left wing. I mean, I'm an intellectual tour guide, right? My job is to make ideas come alive and have students have rational debate about that. And when you do that, particularly in a technology school, the last thing you want to do, you won't connect with students. You'll be inherently alienating, is if you come across as being on that spectrum in a way that would be Luddite, right? I mean, you can't have meaningful conversations with people if that's already where you are. You're already going to be shutting off most people. You could have, a very myopic, sort of insiderish world, but that's not very effective. It's not very pragmatic, and I don't think it's very rich or nuanced. So I'm certainly somebody who in many ways is all about the fact that we are, we are cyborgs, and it's a question then of, as we're designing the world that's going to be more and more directly impacting how we're, communicating with others, how we're registering our thoughts, and, even how we think through things, that to me becomes where the action's at. So if I were to think about people whose work I admire, in the philosophy of technology is definitely a vibrant field within philosophy. I mean, there are organizations like the Society for Philosophy of Technology. There are a few good journals. There's, Techne has been in existence for a while. There's, Philosophy and Technology, which is more recent. But in terms of people whose ideas I really admire, I would say here's a couple. I did not fully appreciate when I was younger, but now I'm becoming much more attracted to a philosopher out in Montana named Albert Borgmann. He has done a series of really interesting books on technology and the good life. And people often claim that this guy is a Luddite, and when I was younger and not as appreciative as I should have been, I think I was more critical. But he really put his finger on the core problem of how our basic everyday interactions with commodities that are designed to make life as frictionless as possible have a potent effect on our character, on the habits that we form and the kinds of people we become. So I think Borgmann's work is fascinating. I'm still very influenced by people in the sort of phenomenology tradition. When I was a grad student, my advisor was a guy named Don Eide, who did very interesting work just on how technology mediates how we think, perceive, and act. And right now, there's a Dutch philosopher named Peter Paul Verbeek, who sort of picked up that torch and really does sort of fantastic work in trying to figure out how the mediation of technology literally affects our full sort of cognitive and emotional beings, and how a failure to understand that in a proper descriptive way can bias our normative debates. In other words, if we begin with a misunderstanding of what the effects are, we have debates that begin on the wrong footing. So very influenced by that. I think Ian Kerr, and I'm coming to his work far too late in my career, I think some of his earlier stuff on looking at the debates around DRM from a virtue ethics perspective, and, you know, his image of sort of Disney's Autotopia, right? This worry that if we could have these sort of perfect systems that would prevent us from behaving poorly, whether that would eliminate the opportunities to develop practical wisdom and virtues. In terms of people that are, you know, sort of out there right now that are doing a lot of new work, I'm a big fan of Evgeny Morozov. I know people find him to be a polarizing figure, but I found his book on thinking about solutionism, although he's more polemical than I can be, his core insights are fascinating. And although he's shifted the conversation to a predominantly political register and a register of political economy, there are certainly points of his writing where he's thinking about similar things, about technology's effects upon our virtue. There's a philosopher sort of my age who's out in California named Shannon Valor, who's doing some things on moral attention now that I think are fascinating. Just asking yourself the question of what are the moral dimensions of what I'm paying attention to? How does what I pay attention to itself constitute a moral act, and how does technology affect that? I think Patrick Lin, another, you know, sort of younger philosopher out in California, who's writing about the complexity of automating ethics and self-driving cars, I think this is fantastic stuff because it shows how even the very idea that we could, you know, figure out in a simplistic way how to do things like drive without, you know, causing harm, it's much more complicated. So this is a long-winded way of saying the people that I'm interested in are people that have a set of intuitions about core ideas, but I'm really not attracted to any figures who feel like, you know, the world is going to hell in a handbasket, or there was some sort of less technologically mediated time that was inherently better. I mean, any of the tools we're going to use, like literal tools and conceptual tools, absolutely have to appreciate the fact that we're in the middle of a big experiment, and it's only going to be continuing through in a kind of mediated way that we can figure out how to flourish.
We're chatting with Evan Selinger of RIT on KZSU-FM Stanford and Hearsay Culture. For those of you that listen to Hearsay Culture regularly, you know that it's on KZSU, which is a non-profit, non-commercial radio station at Stanford University that requires donations from listeners like you to continue its diverse programming. You have a couple of ways that you can make a donation. You could email our underwriting department at underwriting@kzsu.stanford.edu, or go to our webpage and click on Donate to KZSU. Regardless, I hope that you continue to listen to the station and to the show. So Evan, let me ask you this question. I mean, you know, we can start with, you know, humanity writ large, and then we can talk about morality and consciousness and some of the other areas that you're thinking about. So if we start with humanity, which of course is kind of the broadest topic, right? Perhaps we can, you know, think about love itself. And I'm curious to get your take on the movie Her, right? The Joaquin Phoenix movie that came out last year, where he was interacting with an operating system played through the voice of Scarlett Johansson, and in very interesting ways falls in love, and I'll put that in quotes, and has a relationship and shares intimacies and shares humor with literally, as is portrayed in the film, holding what looks like an iPhone, right, or his computer with him and having this kind of interpersonal relationship. Now, putting aside the science fiction-y aspects of it and whether technology is at that point, I'll kind of save that for, you know, a different question, perhaps a different conversation. But from a philosophical and ethical standpoint, what's your take on that as outsourcing?
I think the movie Her is fantastic. I mean, it's the kind of movie that we need right now. And it's fantastic because it's hard to get these ideas out there in a way that will generate mass consideration. And that's something cinema can do when it works well. The problem with Her is I think most people focused on the parts of it that I find less interesting. They focus more on some of the overt themes. So the overt themes, as you pointed out, really, you know, are about how deeply entangled should we become with our technologies? You know, can we fall in love with an operating system? Should we fall in love with an operating system? If operating systems ever could develop to such a degree that they appeared to have intentions and desires of their own, are we sort of morally obligated to, you know, allow them to do their own thing? So most people looked at that movie and were wondering about where our priorities are with respect to something like, you know, maybe rights for artificial intelligence, and interpersonally, whether this was a way of thinking that we're becoming too detached from our connections with other people. The movie has got all of that, and to be sure, that's at the foreground. But for me, as I, you know, this is my own set of interests, I see the movie as asking a completely different set of questions, but you've got to read it against those dominant interpretations. For me, the most fascinating bits of the movie have to do with when the protagonist, in a way that he sees as good and looking after himself and just taking advantage of the ability to have a sort of technological assistant take over tasks for him, whether or not each of these delegations is as good for him as he thinks. So we've got this guy, and he's heartbroken about, a past relationship that didn't work. And so as the movie unfolds, he begins turning to this digital assistant to take over more and more of his life. You know, at one point he's getting potentially a bad update. So he, you know, the operating system sort of scans his email and, you know, has to figure out whether he's emotionally ready to hear certain kinds of news. He starts having the assistant look over his work and make some recommendations that, of course, he's going to take full credit for. He's feeling depressed, and the operating system will sort of coax him out of bed and into the world. And he thinks that's great because, you know, on some level, isn't it better to be out and engaged as opposed to sort of so emotionally distraught that you're unable to leave your house? And sort of by the end of the movie, this guy fancies himself a writer to some extent, but he's never quite, you know, figured out which of his snippets are the best, and he's never sent them to an editor. And the operating system literally does that for him, right? Executes judgment and says, these are your best pieces. I'm not even going to dialogue with you. I've determined that on your behalf. Sends them out, you know, to an agent as if she was the protagonist. The agent thinks this is fantastic. You get the impression a book contract is coming. And this guy couldn't be happier. In short, the protagonist couldn't be happier because he's got a set of goals, and these goals seem to be reached better as a result of giving up more of his life, right? Now he might be on track to being a writer, and he certainly seems better adjusted, a little bit more sort of emotionally stable. And from an output perspective, these are admittedly good things, right? I'm not romanticizing being depressed or not, you know, not being able to actualize your dreams. So from an output perspective, I think these are great. The question I see the movie is raising is whether focusing solely on the output, on the goals being met, even on the goals that he set up for himself. So he's not a corporate stooge, right? So it's not as if he came up with these goals because, I don't know, the advertising industry sort of, you know, manipulated him. Right? These are goals that he had. Is it possible that we could have self-formed goals and get them, and it's still a tragedy instead of a moment that we should all be applauding? That's the question I'm raising. Because for me, what Hurt asks us to consider is whether the means of accomplishing those goals are as important to the story as the accomplishment of the goals themselves. And I think the answer is yes. I think what Hur is beckoning us to consider is the more work, the more labor we begin to delegate, in this case, the more of his life that he gives over to this smart assistant, the less, in a sense, the less virtue he builds up, the less conscientious he might be prone to becoming, the less willing to develop and trust his own judgment, his own connoisseurship, maybe even a less self-control and discipline, a little less self-awareness. And so you have to ask the question of not just does he get what he wants, but does he become the kind of person who gets those things that could be proud of being that person. So it's not just the goals that we have questions about, but does he really deserve those outcomes? I mean, you could really ask the question, if you can't figure out, if you want to be an author and you can't figure out, you know, which of your stuff is great, even at least, you know, have a sense that, well, I feel strongly about this. If somebody else needs to take over all of that for you, who's really secured the contract? Is it him based on his work? Is it him based on his work in part, but also in part based on his operating system's ability to sort of, you know, suss out its value and then take affirmative action? And so is there sort of distributed responsibility for that? But certainly the contract isn't going to him and his operating system. In the end, it looks like something that he's earned all on his own. And is there something a little bit self-deceptive in seeing that? Those to me are the questions I think Her sort of raises on a deep and fundamental level. And in that way, the protagonist becomes sort of all of us who are at the crossroads who have to make these kinds of decisions. And I think these decisions are going to become more fraught as sort of time passes.
Well, and I think we, and we're chatting with Evan Selinger of RIT on KZSU FM Stanford and Hearsay Culture. You know, as you were answering that question, Evan, and it occurred to me, and I'm going to ask you this contrast, and this we're moving now from film and fantasy to extremely harsh and tragic reality. You know, as you were speaking, I was thinking about Elliot Rodger, the young man who horrifically killed several people just a few days ago, and we're recording this show on May 27th, 2014, so this is fresh in our news. Roger, as we are starting to learn about him, had a very active life online. He had a Facebook page. He wrote a 140,000-word, what the press is calling manifesto, which I have not read, but I've seen excerpts of. But most interestingly, in terms of figuring out how this young man got to this point, and I think raising many of the issues that you just discussed with regard to Her, particularly in terms of people's wants and desires and how they get there, he had a very active relationship, and I'm going to use that word, with YouTube, where he posted videos of himself, and they are available publicly. They have not been taken down, at least I'm not, well, maybe some have been, but I've seen others, where in a couple of the videos that I watched, trying to make my own sense and understanding of why these things happen, he is railing against society and women, and there appears to be some self-hatred issues involved, and he growing up as he apparently did in the LA area, he has very I think scripted views of society and how men interact with women and so forth. At any rate, my question is this, and I recognize that I mean, again, this is fast moving news, and so it's important again to note the date and that we have very little information so far. You know, but this is a young man who turned to violence, not only in killing random strangers, but then killing himself. And I'm thinking of YouTube as this mediated outsourcing technology in that way, that he was communicating with the outside world, but he also seems to be communicating with himself. And so I'm recognizing that we've gone from a movie to something extremely harsh and extremely painful, and extremely current. I respect if you want to defer on this, but as I was listening to your question, I was thinking, boy, is that another example of outsourcing, of course, gone in a very different and tragic direction. I mean, what's your sense of, from what we know of that situation, what's your sense of it now in light of your concerns, if you have any?
I think I'll respond more to the way that you framed it, mm-hmm. than any other sort of thing, because that's what you're focusing on. Mm-hmm. The way that you're talking about YouTube in this scenario strikes me as more about mediation than about outsourcing. Outsourcing, okay. For me, and maybe you could correct me here, maybe I'm missing the nuance of the way that you're seeing this, outsourcing would involve something taking over some work for us, right? So in the Her examples, Samantha is literally correcting the letters that the protagonist is writing. Samantha is literally saying, you know, you can't rely on your own internal motivation to get out of bed. So I am telling you, get out of bed. You can't rely on your own judgment to figure out which of your, you know, writing is, you know, ideal. Let me do that for you. So outsourcing always involves having, it could be a person or, in the stuff I'm interested in, a technology doing more of the work for us. The way I heard you describing YouTube, I would put that within the context of this phenomenology of mediation. Mm-hmm. It seems like I hear you asking the question, was he using the medium as a way of communicating to the world such that the content of his communication was affected by the fact that it was being presented in that medium? In other words, knowing that he could have a certain type of a presentation that could go out to a certain number of people, did that possibility of dissemination affect how he spoke about his ideas? Did it influence the production of a certain type of a countercultural or malcontent or guru persona? I hear you asking more of that, or am I missing what you're asking?
No, I think that's a fair critique, and I think you're right. I guess I was thinking about it in light of your concerns with regard to humanity and willpower and conscientiousness. That in that sense, and again, and correct me if I'm wrong, because the focus is on your ideas and not my thoughts about them. But my thinking was that YouTube can be viewed as not just a medium for communication, but as a relationship of sorts. In other words, you know, and I am not a psychologist, I am not trained as one, and so I'm not going to even begin to proffer, but, you know, whether he is communicating with the outside world in a way to get what he wants versus having that same kind of interaction, that human interaction that Joaquin Phoenix has with the operating system and her, I think is a challenging question. And so while it serves as a medium, I was thinking, as you were talking about her, that we might find similar concerns about the pathways to where we get, where the pathways that we use to get to our wants and desires, and then those desires themselves, and seeing YouTube as a form of that outsourcing technology. In other words, it became a substitute, perhaps. And again, I recognize, I don't want to say this, you know, clearly, that I am speculating here, but I think it's important to think about that he was outsourcing, in a sense, his own ability, as you have raised this concern, right, to have direct human relationships, right, by picking up the phone, by meeting people, to YouTube. Having said that, of course, it appears, the manifesto is to be trusted at all, that he made other efforts when he was younger to interact with people directly. But I don't know. I mean, this question has already been way too long, and I want to focus on your ideas.
No,
but what's your take on that?
You're putting your finger on something very interesting, which is, I think there's a very close relation that we always need to think about between mediation and outsourcing.
Okay.
So what I hear you getting at is, I mean, it's a very sort of, you know, to put it in sociological terms, it's about performance, you know, sort of, you know, a lot of the stuff Irving Goffman talked about. I hear you asking the question of whether his relationship to a medium led him to perform, or inclined him, or motivated him, or, you know, fill in the appropriate sort of causal language, mm-hmm. to perform in a certain way. We can't understand outsourcing without understanding that mediation. But for me, the outsourcing would be if, for example, let's run this as a thought experiment. Mm-hmm. Let's say that all of a sudden a future version of YouTube had something like natural language processing built into it that would be constantly mining the content and analyzing the sort of psychological state of the people producing that. We could ask the question, would we want to have a file sharing service so that if certain types of messages were being promoted, algorithms might respond directly and say, you know, are you sure you want to post this? How are you feeling? In other words, some of the reflective work on that, rather than assuming that the agent could be self-reflective, that I could see as a related outsourcing. You know, it's sort of like building in filters into programs to see whether or not there are, you know, sort of cries for attention and things like that. So I would see these as related but slightly separate issues.
Mm-hmm. Well, let me ask you this, Evan, and we're approaching close to what I call the unfair portion of the show, where
sure.
I start asking questions that you may not have time to answer, particularly if I have four-minute questions that I ask, in which case it's really unfair. So I'm going to make this one quick. You mentioned earlier that you are a cyborg, and you certainly are one that focuses on cyborg theory. For those that are not familiar, What is that theory, and how does that fit into your concerns about outsourcing?
So the word cyborg, right, it's one of these words in academia. Too many people use it, and they use it in too many different ways. And for me, I'm going to use it in a very precise way.
Okay.
There's a philosopher named Andy Clark, and he's written books like Natural Born Cyborgs and others, where the basic gist of his core idea is this. If you look at what it is to be human from a natural evolutionary perspective, right, a sort of Darwinian perspective, you can come to the conclusion that we're very good at certain things and very bad at others. So, for example, we're excellent at pattern recognition, right? This is why when it comes to websites trying to authenticate if you're real, they'll ask you to sort of, like, you know, type in what you see. We're much less good at memorizing long serial lists and executing things based on them, right? And so Clark argues that if you look at who we are from this sort of naturalist perspective, you'll see that we are primed. We are sort of, you know, it's sort of in our DNA to be cognitive opportunists, right? To take advantage of externalizing to technology and the both natural and built environment things that we would find it hard to do based solely on our biological resources, right? So the invention of writing, for example, was a tremendous, you know, upgrade, he says, in our sort of cyborgian life, because it enabled us to take thoughts that otherwise were just stored internally. You get to put them out in the world. Putting them out in the world not only adds durability and stability, but it changes what can happen with a public community of inquirers, of almost, you know, sort of scientists, because then we can exchange ideas in a different kind of way and build upon them. And so, in short, I think Clark's instincts about the fact that there is something about who we are that really does make it natural in some way to constantly try to expand the boundaries of how we process information and the boundaries of our minds through technology, that to go back to your earlier question about Luddite, I think is just so empirically right that there's no way to step outside of that. And in some ways, Clark is thinking about a certain type of outsourcing. But for him, it's about cognition. How we become sort of more sophisticated cognitive systems by building and integrating these sort of devices and socio-technical systems that expand what the mind can do. What I want to figure out is what's the difference between the kinds of cognitive outsourcing that might just enable us to be better problem solvers and better communicators and have better storage capacity. How do we differentiate or demarcate that cognitive outsourcing from what I'm worried about, which is moral outsourcing, which is outsourcing tasks that will either atrophy some of our virtues or make some of the virtues harder to acquire. And at least in the stuff that I've looked at, I don't see too many people focusing on that difference.
My colleague Mike Rich at Elon Law has written about technologies that prevent or purport to prevent the commission of crimes. And one of the interesting things that he's written about is that, you know, one concern about those technologies is that we may actually want people, and I put that in quotes, to have the ability to make that choice. In other words, to make the ability to have the ability to decide whether to commit a crime. And I'm curious whether that, you know, that ties in with another concern that you've alluded to earlier that I want to ask you about, which is, you know, as we say, many of us say to our children, right, it's not whether you win or lose, it's how you play the game, and that the path that to which you reach your desires and wants is important. So what's your take on that issue of making choices, even if those choices are not socially optimal, can hurt people, can kill people, and so forth?
You're asking the question that I'm constantly thinking through, and that's exactly that link between the micro and the macro, which is why I brought up that earlier example of what the parents do when mm-hmm. it becomes so much easier to survey their kids, right?
Right.
If you want to have your kid absolutely safe, there's all kinds of things you could do at the expense of preventing them from getting hurt. And many of these things will also prevent them from becoming the kinds of people who know how to deal with the freedom to experiment, make certain choices, and own in a sort of accountable way what those decisions are. And in many ways, that's exactly the question. I mean, I'll give a shout out here to, you know, you mentioned Woody Hartzog, who is, you know, my favorite collaborator in work that he's done that has nothing to do with anything I've done with him. You know, he's written about automated law enforcement, mm-hmm. and he's raised this question of, you know, what are some of the trade-offs if we could have sort of perfect automated law enforcement? And when you raise the question, as others have had, about, you know, how far we would want to go to prevent crime, right? Some of these pre-crime scenarios. And even this connects up with, you know, Ian Kerr's stuff on Virtue and DRM. The question always becomes, the more that it becomes possible to create code and structure that prevents certain bad actions from happening, and no one's in favor of bad actions, right? No one wants kids to be hurt. No one wants crimes to be committed. But just because we don't want those outcomes, it isn't a foregone conclusion that any means necessary validates preventing those outcomes from arising, right? There are all kinds of trade-offs that happen, and the big question becomes not just what are the outcomes we want to avoid, but what kinds of people do we want to be? What kinds of citizens do we want a society to create? And that's always the huge question of these trade-offs between security, safety, and what I would consider to be other virtues. Virtues like the capacity to be responsible for freely chosen action, etc. So I don't have an easy answer for any of this, but to me these are the live questions we always need to ask whenever there's an opportunity to create some system that will enhance some of those goals at the expense of potentially minimizing our capacity to develop what, you know, over 2,000 years ago Aristotle called phronesis, or practical wisdom.
Evan, we're closing in here in about 2 minutes, and I want to ask you this anecdotal question and kind of get your overarching take on it before I ask you really just to the extent you want to fill in my listeners with regard to the status of this project. So I was a resident director of an undergraduate residence hall when I was in law school, and while I was in law school, I was able to, you know, get a very good idea of how undergrads, and this was in the mid-1990s, were interacting. And one of the interesting things that I remember were two roommates who were emailing each other through the computer system, sitting next to each other in their dorm room. And I found that to be just mind-boggling and a bit humorous. Of course, fast forward now nearly 20 years later, right, and you see kids texting each other while they're sitting next to each other, and, of course, we're interacting with each other in all kinds of impersonal ways that were, like I said, laughable and noteworthy 20 years ago. I'm not asking you to pull out your crystal ball, but I'm curious of your perspective on this. I mean, as we have mediated communications and the concerns that you've raised with regard to those outsourcing our humanity, would you expect that technology will integrate itself to such a degree that we will find technology and our humanity synonymous? And I'm not asking from a crystal ball perspective or predictions as much as your take on, where technology could bring us.
Then my quick answer to that would be to point two things. I think you're asking questions about etiquette with this last bit, but etiquette and ethics overlap in ways that I think most people are a little tone deaf to. We often think that it's just a question of whether it's being polite or not polite to speak in a certain way or not speak in a certain way. But this goes back to the issue of moral attention. How we pay attention, who we pay attention to me these are profoundly moral questions. And what worries me is that the more difficult it becomes to find a way to answer these practical everyday issues in a satisfying way, the more I'm worried we will begin to outsource those solutions to technology itself, to having all kinds of technological prompts that tell us, you know, pretend to make eye contact here, you know, add this to personalize your email. In other words, if the trajectory works in a certain way, rather than developing an understanding about the ethical dimensions of this and the importance of making contextually appropriate decisions and putting in a certain amount of effort, the worst thing that could happen would be trying to solve the very problem that a certain type of mediation has created by having over-reliance on further outsourcing. So that is something I'm worried about.
My students ask me sometimes how they will get all of these rules and contracts and intellectual property and such into their head, and I say, well, you could memorize them, But the better way to do it is to understand the policy and why we're here, and the rules will become more intuitive. And it sounds to me like, in my very crude teaching law way, that I have, that there might be a bridge between that and these broader issues of outsourcing morality and humanity about which you're writing. Evan, in the last 20 seconds here, anything you want to say about the status of this project? Because obviously critical and fascinating, and I'm looking forward to more of your thoughts and writings on this topic.
Oh, thanks. So the quick answer is, you know, working on the book proposal now. Hope to spend the next, you know, year writing it up. And as always, you know, I'm constantly writing things towards that as they come out. So, you know, it's very easy with things like, you know, I don't know, social media, Twitter, a website to sort of see what I'm up to. So.
Evan Selinger, Associate Professor of Philosophy at Rochester Institute of Technology. Thank you for joining us on Hearsay Culture. May I invite you back, you know, once the book is, or you feel that the book is in a position where you want to talk about these issues in more detail. Clearly incredibly important issues that I'm looking forward to learning from you on these issues so that I can perhaps make my life more human and less mediated. Thank you for joining us today on the show.
Thanks for having me. Love to be back.
So we have one more show in this quarter of Hearsay Culture schedule before we go into interim. Next week, Nabiha Syed is going to be on discussing her focus on technology and journalism. The show will then enter hiatus for the bulk of the month of June, and we will pick up new shows towards the end of June. I'm in the process now or over the next few weeks in booking guests for the summer quarter on KZSU. So I certainly encourage you to email me at dave@hearsayculture.com if you have any suggestions for people that should be on the show, as well as any feedbacks, comments, and suggestions. This quarter, you've been able to listen to Hearsay Culture at 2 p.m. Pacific time on Wednesdays at KZSU, where you can stream it live at kzsulive.stanford.edu. You can also get the show via podcast after it airs on KZSU by going to Stanford's Center for Internet Society webpage at cyberlaw.stanford.edu, by going to the iTunes page for CIS, or by going to hearsayculture.com, where you can get all 210 plus past shows, as well as the upcoming schedule. Over the last month, I've been busy working on international trade issues, on issues involving information access and hydraulic fracturing, as well as having to grade some exams. So I am a little behind in posting shows, but as this show is going to be airing Wednesday, May 28th, by the time you hear this show, many of those shows, if not all of them, should be posted, and then I'll be moving forward from there. So from Professor Lemley, who was on several weeks ago now, through Ryan Kahlo and Woody Hartzog, you will be able to find those shows. So thank you for joining today on Hearsay Culture. Please stay tuned to KZSU for more diverse programming, and have a great day.